We are in our final week of a study on fellowship, and I really want to encourage you to think about it. This is something that we're going to focus on, not just in the first 8 weeks of the year, but really throughout the year, but just to think about it on a personal level. And this morning, we're talking about fellowship and friendship, and I kind of debated on this topic because friendship seems like kind of a shallow topic compared to some of the other things we've talked about, suffering and service and giving. But I think it's really an important aspect of fellowship that we often don't consider. And honestly, I think that for a lot of us, that it's kind of taken a back seat to a lot of other things in life. Sometimes it's devalued. People don't see the need for it or see that it's an important part of their lives. And the other reality is it takes time. I mean, building friendship takes a lot of time. And, you know, when kids are in high school or middle school, I mean, that's all they have. I mean, they hang out with their friends, you know. They go to school with them. They come home. They call them. Now they play games with them online or go out to be together or drive around together. And I remember when I was in high school, that as soon as I got my license, that's all we did. We just drove around and we just hung out. We didn't even have plans. We just wasted gas. But it was the friendship that was important. And then went to college, and I went to a small Christian college. Going to Walmart was an event. We'd actually planned for it. You know, there wasn't a lot to do there. But it didn't matter because it wasn't about what we were doing. It was about the fact that we were together and we had built that kind of relationship. But the reality is as you get older, whether you're single, you get a job, or you start dating and you get married, and suddenly you have less time, and so friendship begins to take a back seat. And then of course you have children, and then friendship takes even more of a back seat because all of your time seems to be taken up with just living life. But of course, whether you're single or married, as you get older, life just seems to get busier. And one of the things that falls by the wayside so often is friendships. In fact, I just started a cohort with the district this past Friday, and it's on the topic of friendship and pastors. And one of the reasons why is he was sharing a statistic. And among pastors, they said that about 50% said that they were lonely all the time, and another 20% said they were lonely a lot of the time. I don't know how accurate those statistics are. I've never really taken a poll, but I understand where they're coming from. But I realize it's not just pastors. It's not just, you know, in ministry. It's really life that can cause us to devalue this. Let me share something that C.S. Lewis wrote in his book, The Four Loves. And if you've never read it, I encourage you to read it. Just a lot of practical insight into relationships. But one of the things he talks about in there is on friendship, and he writes this. He says, "To the ancients, friendship seems the happiest and most fully human of all loves, the crown of life, the school of virtue. The modern world, in comparison, ignores it. We admit, of course, that besides a wife and a family, a man needs a few friends, but the very tone of the admission and the sort of acquaintanceships which those who make it would describe as friendships show clearly what they are talking about has very little in common with the ancients. It's something quite marginal, not a main course in life's banquet, a diversion, something that fills up the chinks of one's time." And then he asks, how has this come about? He says, the first and most obvious answer is that few value it because few experience it. He goes on to compare friendship the difference between that and a love affair. And he says, lovers always talk to one another about their love. Friends hardly ever about their friendship. Lovers are normally face-to-face, absorbed in each other. Friends side-by-side, absorbed in some common interest. And over in the Bible speaks about the topic of friendship. And Lewis comments, friendship makes good men better and bad men worse. But the Bible is replete with references to friendship, to this relationship. In fact, the passage that I just read earlier in the service, let me read it again and just think about what it's saying. It says, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Woe to the one who, when he falls, no one's there to help him. Nobody may even notice that he fell. And so in very practical ways, we can see the spiritual implications of this and the importance of having people around us, close enough to us, that they see when something isn't right. Proverbs 18:24 says, a man of too many friends comes to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And we're going to talk about that because there are different different types of friends, maybe different levels of friendships. Again, these are things that as we think about our lives, as we look at it, we see that we're closer to some than others. And Proverbs notices that there is a friend that is closer than a brother. Hebrews adds this in Hebrews 3:13. It says, but encourage one another day after day, as long as it is still called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. And the practical reality is that we have indwelling sin in our lives, and it says, Peter says, it wages war against our soul, so there's this internal battle that we have, and then we live in a world that is saturated with sin. And we have an enemy of our souls who is opposed to us, who's constantly trying to find ways to cause us to stumble and to fall. But notice what Hebrews says. He says, encourage one another day after day. Now, the only way you can encourage somebody day after day is if you're in their life day after day. If you're close enough and you communicate enough and you're in fellowship enough and related to each other close enough, that you can encourage one another every day. And for us, the reality of it and what we need to realize is we need friends. I need friends. You need friends. Because as we look at this passage, it reminds us that sin is always there, crouching at the door, ready to deceive us, and we need each other. We need to be in relationship with one another in order to encourage each other because of the reality of sin. Jesus noted this. He says, greater love has no one than this, than one lay down his life for his friends. And that's an amazing reality. One, that Jesus called his disciples friends, but more than that, he calls us his friend. That Jesus Christ died on the cross to pay the penalty for our sins so that we could have an intimate relationship with him that begins the moment we accept Christ and goes throughout eternity. That's what it means to have a relationship with Christ. Yes, we're forgiven of our sins. Yes, we are going to heaven. But the beauty of heaven is the fact that we're there with God. And so this reality of friendship isn't something that's just peripheral or secondary or unessential. I would say that it's essential to the Christian life. And so this morning, I'd like to answer three questions about friendship. First of all, what are the levels of friendship? And then secondly, what are the characteristics of friendship? And then finally, how can we acquire this type of friend? What are the levels of friendship? And I'm going to share something, and I mentioned this a few weeks ago, but I'm going to share something that I heard on a sermon about 35 years ago, but it has stuck with me, and I've seen it to be a practical reality in life. And of course, this pastor, I don't even remember the name of the pastor or anything else about that other than I was listening to it on the radio and it just struck a chord with me as a young Christian. And he said that there he divided it into four different levels of friendship. And he said, think of it as concentric circles starting on the outside. Now, everyone outside of that circle, of course, are strangers. They're people that we don't know. But then he said, and the outer layer of that circle are acquaintances. And he said, these are people you rub shoulders with and you recognize. Now, you might say hi to them. You might, if you run into them, you might, you know, have small talk with them. You know, Jesus had a multitude of people that were curious, you know, and they came around him, but they didn't have a relationship with him. And we know a lot of people, I mean, not just here in the church, but in our neighborhood, where we go to school or where we go to work. We bump into people, but we don't really have a relationship with them. We might know enough to know their name and maybe a few little facts about their lives, but they're just acquaintances. And then this author pointed out fair-weather friends. And we're familiar with the term of fair-weather friends. And these are people that you might sit with in church sometimes or even go out for dessert. They're nice people, but they don't really know you that deeply. You wouldn't call them up if you had a problem. You wouldn't necessarily bare your heart to them, or if you were struggling, open up to them. And so they're fair-weather friends. When things are going well, they're there. But when the storms come, they're gone. In fact, we see this in Jesus' ministry. If you remember in John chapter 6, Jesus began to say some hard teachings. He began to say things that they were struggling with. And in John chapter 6, verse 66, it says this, as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. So when things were good, when things were exciting and interesting, they were there. But as soon as it became difficult, they walked away. Well, then this author noted good friends, and he said, these are people that you wouldn't just send a Christmas card to, but you'd buy a present for. These are people that you talk to on the phone and even have vacations together. And these good friends are people that know us in a lot of ways, and they know a lot about us, and we share life together, but there are areas in our life we just kind of hold to the side. We just don't share with them. There's just aspects of our lives that we keep to ourselves. And so they're good friends. They're genuine friends. And again, I think when I was a kid, I mean, hanging out with most of my friends, I mean, we had a great time together. But did we ever really get that personal? And then what this author called intimate friends. I like a word that I heard. We don't use this word anymore. It actually comes from the Puritans. The Puritans actually had a lot to say about friendships, and they would talk about having a bosom friend. This kind of comes from the King James. The bosom was where your heart was. And the Puritans would talk about these bosom friends, these friends that were just heart friends. They were intimate friends. They were close, but they went beyond just the superficiality of life, that they knew you at the depths of who you are. Patrick Morley, in his book, The Man in the Mirror, he says this. He says, he wryly observes that while most men could recruit six pallbearers, he says, hardly anyone has a friend he can call at 2 a.m. These are people that know you warts and all, and they bring out the best in you. They know your secret dreams, and they know your secret fears. They know who you are. They know what makes you tick. Now, one of the friendships that I've looked at and thought, man, I want to model my friendships after this was actually these two ladies when I was at Shell Point. It was Corey Staub and Dorothy Harvey. I found out Dorothy Harvey, that her son was actually my missions professor and had been a missionary, career missionary, and all of the Harveys had been in ministry. But Corey Staub and Dorothy Harvey, they had been friends since kindergarten. They had been friends for 80 years at that point. They had laughed together. They had cried together. They had supported one another. They had rejoiced at the birth of their children. They cried at the deaths of their spouses. The first time I met Dorothy, she was quick to talk about Corey. And when I met Corey, she fondly talked about Dorothy. And I thought, what a beautiful relationship that now they're worshiping the Lord together in eternity as friends. That you're transparent, your life is an open book. You know, I think that Peter, James, and John fall into this category. You know, when you trace through the gospel accounts, what's really interesting is at some of those very key pivotal moments in the life of Jesus, he brought three of his apostles with him: Peter, James, and John. In fact, you look at the transfiguration in Matthew chapter 17. And as you look at it, he brought three of his disciples with him: Peter, James, and John. In Gethsemane, there was, again, three of his disciples that he brought with him: Peter, James, and John. And in fact, of those three, we find that John describes himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved. Now, the first Christmas when I was out of college, I did something really stupid. It was Christmas time, and I wasn't going to fly home. I didn't have a lot of vacation. And so I was going to have Christmas there and was going over to some friend's house later in the day. But as Christmas presents came in, I opened them when they arrived. I didn't think a big deal of it, but I was like, hey, there's a present. So I opened it. You know, so the week before Christmas, as I got presents, I opened them, not realizing on Christmas morning when I woke up and I walked into my living room and I saw my Christmas tree barren with no presents, emotionally, that really affected me. And so a little bit later in that day, my best friend from college called me, and I just began talking to him about how upset I was, how sad I was, and just talking to him. And he listened sympathetically to me for a few minutes, and then he said, okay, Dave, that's enough. He's like, get over it. It's not the end of the world. Now, that may seem cruel, but he knew me, and he knew that's what I needed to hear, to just put it in perspective. And honestly, it was a wake-up call and just all of the things that I had to be grateful for. But what are the characteristics of this type of friendship? And I want to use as a model David and Jonathan in the Old Testament. If you remember the story of David and Jonathan in 1 Samuel chapter 18 and following into 2 Samuel chapter 1, there's a story of David and Jonathan, and it's a very unusual story. Jonathan is the son of King Saul. And as you know how monarchies work, he would have been the heir apparent. He would have been the one that the mantle would have fallen on if it had gone through that progression, that Jonathan would have been the next king. But as you read the story in the Old Testament, you find that God had judged Saul because of Saul's rebellion and sin against him, and Saul was being set aside, and that God had appointed David, this young shepherd boy, to be the next king. And so David was going to be, by God's ordained decision, to be the next king. And so this shepherd boy, who was for a time brought in to be a musician to Saul, also killed Goliath, as you remember the story. But Jonathan, who would have been older than David, by the way, they struck up this friendship. And so we read about it in 1 Samuel, beginning in chapter 18. But there are some of the characteristics I just want to pull out. I can't go through all of the story of it. But the first thing you see as you look at this friendship is the love and affection that they had for one another. Look at, if you have your Bibles open, I'll just point out a few of the passages. And in 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 1, it says this: as soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And then again it says it in verse 3, then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. So one of the characteristics we see of their friendship, and I think of these of any of these intimate kind of friendships, is this love that we have for another person. Now, in addition to that, we also see in verse 3 that they were committed to one another. Look at in verse 3 again. It says, Jonathan made a covenant with David. And when they made a covenant with one another, they were saying, what happens to you happens to me. And what happens to me happens to you, that we're in this life together. And that was the relationship that they had. What's mine is yours. And I pledge myself to you. Another thing that we see that's demonstrated in this relationship, in this friendship, is that the honesty that they have. Now, remember, Jonathan was supposed to be the next king. Now, Jonathan knew that David was the one that God had appointed to be the next king, and that caused problems between Jonathan and his father Saul. But in spite of all of that, there was a level of honesty that Jonathan had with David. And in chapter 19, verses 1 and 2, Jonathan warns David that his father wants to take his life. He says, I must tell you this. And I think how much that took for him to be honest on something that directly affected him and directly affected the relationship with his father. But there was an honesty there that we see. And then also there was a loyalty there. In fact, when Saul had decided to kill David, Jonathan warns him and says, I want you to know that my father wants to kill you. And so he goes back to see if this is the case. And Saul starts talking to Jonathan. And he's speaking to his father, and he's trying to learn what's really going on. And it says this in verse 4, and Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father. And I thought, what kind of loyalty they had to one another. That he suspected that his father was going to kill, that wanted to kill David, and yet Jonathan spoke well. There was a loyalty there regardless of the situation. Regardless of what was going on, and regardless of how much it affected him, because he had to know if David lives, he's the king, and I'm going to be set aside. And yet he had committed himself to David in this friendship, in this relationship, that it was through thick or thin. You know, I know that's, you know, I think, you know, there's a difference between dogs and cats. You know, I little side joke. You know, I heard that, you know, your dog, you know, you feed your dog and your dog thinks you're the king, you know, and you feed your cat and the cat thinks that he's the king. You know, dogs are loyal to, I mean, dogs are amazing. Like if you smell, nobody else may come around you, but your dog's going to come right up to you. You know, it doesn't matter. They're loyal. And I think, you know, that we need to have a little more of that loyalty through thick and thin, regardless of what's going on. But one of the other things we find, and I've mentioned this already, is the self-sacrifice that we find. And we see this in chapter 20, verse 4. It says, then Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do for you. And even if it cost him personally, you know, there in Psalms it talks about, you know, making a vow even to your own hurt. You know, and sometimes we promise things, and we don't count the cost of how much it's going to cost, and then we realize later, like, man, that's going to be a lot more than I expected. That's going to take a lot more out of me. It's going to cost a lot more time, and then we have the tendency to back out. But the reality is that God wants us to be people of our words, and especially in our relationships. And so whatever we say we're going to do, we do, even if it costs us personally. And that's what we see. Jonathan knew that this was going to cost him the kingdom. And yet he was willing to, because of his relationship with David, and he knew that God had called David to be the king. We find a few other things. There's confidentiality that we find there. That in verse 6, he promises not to tell his father where he's hiding or where he is. We see the integrity that they have for one another. That in verse 9, Jonathan says, "Far be it from you, if I knew that it was determined by my father to harm should, that harm should come to you, would I not tell you?" He says, "I have the integrity that I would tell you anything. Even the reality of what my father is, even at what it costs me and the relationship I have with him." Again, we find other things that are there in this relationship. Understanding, in verses 15 and 16, David could have been upset with his friend didn't believe him. Because remember, Jonathan is talking to him and he knows what's going to happen. And so he asks David, will you watch over my children? He says, "If I am still alive, show me the steadfast love that I may not die, and do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." And he's saying, "Can you take care of my children if I'm not here anymore?" Now, that could have been an affront to David. David said, "Well, don't you trust me?" But David understood and was sensitive to this reality, and so he makes a promise that he would care for his friend's children. And again, it says, "And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul." And so they affirm their love for one another, their friendship for one another. In fact, the depths of their friendship come out in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel when Jonathan dies. Jonathan and Saul are killed in battle, and David hears about it, and he says this in the end of verse 25 and 26. "Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleased have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women." Now, he wasn't saying that there was anything sexual in their relationship, but he was saying that there was a depth of love in this friendship that was paramount and was important and vital in his life and meant so much to him, that he lamented the loss of that friendship, that he knew he was never going to be able to have that friendship again in this life, and so he mourns over the reality of that, and so we see the depth of his love that he had for his friend Jonathan. Well, how do we find this kind of this type of friendship? How do we acquire this type of friendship? Well, again, one of the things that we see, in 1 Samuel 18:1, it says the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as he loved himself. Well, let me say a few observations about this. One, it takes time. And that's one of the things I was talking about earlier, that the older we get, the harder it becomes to maintain friendships just because of the time that it takes. In fact, there's this mutual self-disclosure that has to happen for a friendship to grow in its depth, to get deeper and deeper. There's a mutual, gradual self-disclosure. And like I said, it's mutual because both sides have to be willing to slowly reveal more of themselves as they get to know one another. If one of them stops sharing, the relationship can't grow beyond that point. But it's gradual. That we shouldn't expect to know everything about somebody all at once. In fact, as I mentioned a couple weeks ago, that's really a turnoff when somebody begins, it's TMI, too much information, when people start to share too much too quickly, because we know intuitively it takes time to get to know each other, to build relationships with one another, that we need to be inquisitive and ask and share and talk about each other, about sharing of ourselves. I mentioned M. Griffin. He talks about two turtles in their shells. He said, that's how we are when we meet somebody, and we slowly stick our head out a little bit more and a little bit more until we're finally fully exposed. And he equates that to friendship. And you can get your head lopped off. And that's the reality of it. And it takes time. And it's a risk. It takes effort and commitment. It takes dropping our guard and sharing our emotions. It means removing our masks, which kind of goes contrary to how we live. The reality is that, you know, we're impression people. We like to give people a certain impression of who we are. And whether we realize it or not, very often it's very easy to begin to wear a mask to give an appearance of how we are to other people. And so, church is one of those places that can become almost second nature without even thinking about it. I mean, that a couple could be in a massive fight right before church, and they walk into the church, and how's it going? It's great, wonderful. And they don't share the reality of what's going on. It goes against our natural inclinations. I shared a long time ago, but I'll mention it again. A friend of mine was in a Sunday school class, and one of the pastors of this large church was teaching Sunday school, and it was the couples class, and he was planning on getting married. And so the teacher walks in, and as they're starting, one of the students says, "Hey, where's your wife? She's not here today. Is she sick?" And he just said, "No. Honestly, we had a fight on the way to church, and she decided she's not coming." Now, we may sit there and be shocked about it, but would we be that honest? And that's what it means to drop our guard. That's what it means to remove our mask. It goes against our natural inclinations of self-preservation. And as I mentioned last time, there's a depth and a breadth in relationships. It's a lot about a person in a lot of different areas. That, if you can have work friends, but you're friends at work, but that's all you ever talk about, or school friends, but that's all you ever talk about. But if you really want to have this type of bosom friend, this type of intimate friendship that the Bible talks about, you need to know the person in a lot of different areas, not just one specific area or two specific areas. And so it takes time, it takes communication, it takes trust, and it needs to be a sharing of your life over all of your life. It's about trust and being trusted. It's a little at a time. It's confidence gained. It's pride dropped. It's being equals in the relationship, equals in the friendship. If we treat each other as subordinates rather than equals, we're never going to be able to drop our guards and to build that type of relationship. And I mentioned a couple weeks ago about a gentleman that I know that, everyone seems to be his subordinate, and so nobody is his peer, and so he doesn't really have that many close friends because he sees them all as people he's ministering to. Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons, you know, when I've thought about this, and again, things that I've mentioned in the past, but I thought about a lot of when I was a young Christian, you had a lot of these scandals of these televangelists and these pastors and ministry, and sadly, they still go on today. But one of the things that I realized is that none of these people had anyone who could confront him. You know, I think about, you know, in fact, if you surround yourself with just people who are yes people and people who are your subordinates, nobody is able to come up to you and tell you the hard things. And so trust and being trusted and treating people as equals is important. Now, why am I sharing this on a sermon on fellowship? Because fellowship and friendship, they're not identical, but they're intimately related with one another. And you can't have a depth of fellowship and encouragement without having a relationship with other people. And so the reason why I put this at the end of the messages on fellowship is really in a very practical way to encourage you to say, look at the relationships you have with other believers. Look at the people who are in your life. Are there people that you can get closer to? Maybe you already have people in your life, but you say, hey, you know, I want to spend some time with this person and get to know this person and move to the next level in our friendship, in our relationship, so that we can become closer friends and we can have more intimate fellowship because we need that. And so it's never too late to begin. You know, this isn't something just for, you know, teenagers and college students or young adults or singles. You know, this is for us, you know, in our 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s. We never stop needing people in our lives. And so they're intimately related with one another, because it's really hard to minister to people deeply when we don't know them well. And so we need to recognize, just on a very basic level, that we need to focus on building friendships with one another, building relationships with one another, if we're going to be able to minister to one another and to be ministered to. Well, let me close by reading one final quote by C.S. Lewis, and he just talks about the reality of friends, but also the fact that it is God who gives us the friends that we have. He says this, he says, in friendship, being free of all that, we think we have chosen our peers. In reality, a few years difference in the dates of our birth, a few more miles between certain houses, the choice of one university instead of another, posting to different regiments, the accident of a topic being raised or not being raised at the first meeting, any of these chances might have kept us apart. But for the Christian, there are, strictly speaking, no chances. A secret master of ceremonies has been at work. Christ, who said to his disciples, "Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you," can truly say to every group of Christian friends, "You have not chosen one another, but I have chosen you for one another." The friendship is not a reward for our discrimination and good taste in finding one another out. It is the instrument by which God reveals to each the beauty of all the others. They are no greater than the beauties of 1,000 other men. By friendship, God opens our eyes to them. They are, like all beauties, derived from Him. And then, in a good friendship, increased by Him through the friendship itself, so that it is His instrument for creating as well as for revealing. At this feast, it is He who has spread the board, and it is He who has chosen the guests. It is He, we may dare to hope, who sometimes does and always should preside. Let us not reckon without our host. Let's pray. Father, I pray for us, for each one of us, Lord, that we will look at our lives to see.